So who wants to talk about the heat capacity of ethane? I think we did enough of that, probably. There must be other things. Somebody must be thinking of something besides that. Yeah, Megan? Temporary diastereomers. Yeah, so we talked about ways to separate enantiomers. What's that process called?
Resolution,
right. Okay, so can you name any ways of... What's the problem with resolving enantiomers? Why can't you just always do it? Why isn't it just trivial? It's the way you separate anything. Why can't you distill them apart? Yeah, they're mirror images. So almost anything in the way they interact with each other would be the same, whether it's right with right or left with left. And the way they interact with most other things, all other things, are they always equal in their... What kind of other things might they react differently with or interact differently with? Yeah.
Other chiral molecules.
Of course, if that other chiral molecule is itself a racemate, so you have both left and right of it, then the left of the molecule you're interested in can interact with the left of the other one, the right with the right. Those will be equivalent, and again, you won't have any properties. But if that other substance is itself resolved so that you have only a single hand, then you have right with right, right with left. What's the relationship between those? Diastereomeric. They're just plain different. So then you have... A very common way to do it is to crystallize in order to separate those things. What other ways could you do it? Yeah. Chromatography would be a good way to do it. In principle, you could do distillation. They'd have different boiling points, except that that most of the times when you make something like that, it's not something that could distill, because by the time you get a molecule big enough that both pieces are chiral, it tends to have a very high melting point. Boiling point. Okay, so, but what's the, so you could take anything else that's chiral that will interact with the molecule you're interested in, the racemate you're interested in. What difficulty would you face then after you had done the separation? That is, after you'd separated the two diastereomers. Yeah, well, yeah. Well, that's not what you wanted. You didn't want that compound. You wanted the separate single molecules. So what do you have to do? You have to somehow reverse the initial reaction. So that's what we meant by temporary, right? You have to be able to form diastereomers somehow so you can do the separation. But then you have to get it apart again to get back to the thing you wanted. So that's why we meant said temporary diastereomers. If you need for some purpose a single enantiomer, well, for what purpose might you want a single enantiomer? If the properties of the two molecules, the right and the left, are for many purposes the same, why would you want to separate them? Yeah. Yeah, if you wanted to react with something biological, if you wanted it to be a drug, for example, then you would want to get, in principle, one enantiomer is better than the other. What's a chiral switch? Is it a switch that has a curve to its handle so that you see different for the right and the left hand? Yeah. It's not usually switching from one enantiomer to another enantiomer, and it can be a loophole, but it could be a genuine contribution. But you don't change from right to left. What do you do? Debbie? You change from the racemate. Because in the old days, like when I was a student or a young faculty member, it was painful to resolve things, right? And it's still, you still have much the same techniques for separation, except that now people do have chromatography columns that are chiral, that are really big enough to do it on some scale. So almost all drugs were, people weren't as sensitive to this sensitivity to the chirality of a drug. So almost all drugs at that time were made in racemic form. And so then, once they'd proven themselves and it was pretty clear that one hand would be better than the other, then people started resolving them and getting a new patent on that and so on. And in many cases, it could be better. Can you think of an example where people thought it would be better? Particular compound, pardon me? Well, that's what AstraZeneca wants you to believe, that the left hand that is better. The where does the name esomeprazole come from?
S.
It's S, omeprazole. So we'll go back to what S is. That would be a good thing to talk about, maybe. So AstraZeneca wants you to believe that. Why do they want you to believe it? Because then they can sell you pills for $5 instead of 50 cents, right? And they have some evidence that it might be better, but the evidence that's on the label isn't very convincing, I don't think. But what's changed in the time that's made it much more possible to work with singline antimers, is that now it's possible to make singline antimers, so you don't have to do a separation and throw half the stuff away, which makes it much more commercially profitable to do this. What's the trick you use to make a singline antimer? Not to make a racemate and separate it, which is what we've been talking about, but just make one. Yeah, Brandon? Right, so we talked about using a titanium catalyst to put an oxygen on in a way that it will be a singline antimer. Now, you said a titanium catalyst. Is that the crude? I mean, the titanium, no doubt, serves a catalytic role. But would you expect any old titanium compound to do that? Why not, Brandon? It has to be a singline antimer if you want to make a singline antimer. And how is it made a singline antimer? The titanium. What do you add? The weird molecule. I think that it's got technically a different name. Debbie?
It's a diethyl tartrate.
Right, it's a diethyl tartrate. So once again, tartaric acid rears its lovely head, right? Can you think of other examples where tartaric acid was important in chirality? Yeah. Speak up.
The biological resolution, the mold ate half the
right. Pasteur found that you could resolve tartaric acid by having Penicillium glaucum eat one of the enantiomers, leaving the other one. Where else did tartaric acid? Yeah, Ellen?
And Hoff rationalized the different rotations of different
enantiomers
in terms of their
rotational frequencies. Right. Van't Hoff could figure out that knowing the constitution of tartaric acid, what's constitution? Natalie? Right, the nature and sequence of bonds, so the two-dimensional diagram you'd draw. That was being figured out at about that time. And what did Van't Hoff notice about that compound and all others that were optically active? Yeah, Matt?
Stereogenic centers.
Right, that they had what we now call stereogenic centers. That's a very modern not from your point of view, from my point of view, a very modern term. It started, stereogenic centers as a word became popular, say, in the 1970s or something like that, but 100 years after Van't Hoff. So the tartaric acid and its isomers were played a big role in Van't Hoff, an important role in Van't Hoff's discoveries. Where it actually played a role even earlier on. What did Berzelius do with it?
He was looking at
right. He knew what did he know about? Did he know that did Berzelius know that tartaric and racemic acid had the same constitution? If not, why not? Well, why didn't he know that they have the same constitution? So what did he say they had?
The same ratios.
I say it again, please.
Composition,
right? Why didn't he say they had the same constitution? What did you have to wait for? Ellen? I can't hear very well. Right, you had to have bonds, right? Remember when that came, roughly? 1858, 1859. Yeah, good, well done. Okay, and what term did Berzelius think of in the context of tartaric and pardon me? Isomer, right? He thought up the word isomer. Okay, any other places where tartaric acid is? Yeah, pardon me. Mitscherlich. What did Mitscherlich do?
He looked at the crystals of tartaric acid, of racemic acid, and found that they had two different shapes, and that the two different crystals were L tartaric and R tartaric.
You've got a good observation, but not the right person. What did Mitscherlich notice about the crystals? Derek? No, he didn't do that. Yeah.
It was the arsenates and the phosphates,
right? Yeah, he studied arsenates and phosphates. What did he notice about arsenates and phosphates?
They're isomorphic.
They're isomorphous. What does that mean?
It means that they have similar structures and be that they're kind of analogous in gold played by different elements of each.
Right. What isomorphous meant was they were the same morph, the same shape. Right, so the angles between faces of the crystals were the same. Before that time, it was thought that each crystal had its own shape, except for some very special, highly symmetric ones. Like if it's a cube, you have three right angles and equal sides. Then there are different molecules that have that. But these weird, but less symmetrical cases where you have different angles, different ratios of sides, it was thought that every compound had its own fingerprint in that way, right? So it was really surprising to find two different ones that had the same. So he thought that this must prove that phosphorus and arsenic fit exactly the same, in that one can replace the other, that they're isomorphous. And then what was that good for? Right, so then you knew that there were the same number of arsenic and phosphorus in corresponding. That is, the ratio of phosphorus to oxygen in the one would be the same as the ratio in atoms of arsenic. So that you knew that what the relative atomic weights of phosphorus and arsenic were. That's good. So that was a very important contribution of Mitscherlich, as you said. But he did observe something about tartaric acid and racemic acid. Yeah.
Just that their crystals have like little facets, like on four edges or the crystal, right?
Yeah, he observed that certain salts at least were isomorphous all he knew was that there were two different things, tartaric and racemic acid. But certain of their salts had the same shape, right? And then who else came on the scene then in repeating? Yeah, Pasteur, what did he observe? That when you found the ones of the same shape from racemic acid, they weren't really the same shape. In what way were they not? No? They were mirror images. They had the same angles among the faces, but in different directions, right? So did that show to Pasteur that tetravalent carbon would be a stereogenic center?
No.
Who said no? Aisha? No. Somebody said no.
Me?
Okay, Debbie, why did you say no? Yeah, the tetravalent carbon is tetrahedral and chiral.
Tetravalence wasn't until like Cooper 10 years later, the tetrahedral wasn't until like 20 odd years later.
That's right, because bonds hadn't been invented yet. Valence hadn't been invented yet. All he knew was that there was something that was handed there. Maybe they were spirals, one right-handed and left-handed spirals or something. He didn't know. There wasn't the basis for knowing it yet. Okay, any place else that Tartar... We started this whole enterprise by saying that Sharpless developed a catalyst that was chiral, that where you could make a single molecule now rather than throwing half your stuff away and after having worked to resolve it. Matt? Yeah? To do what? Can't hear. Right. Good. So you used the word absolute configuration. Why do you need the word absolute? What would be another category of configuration rather than absolute?
Relative.
Relative. What does that mean? Uncle, aunt. Right, big D glyceraldehyde. If you can make it into your compound is big D too. What's little D? What is it? Phenomenological. That one. And what does that mean?
Just the way that it rotates the light.
And what other name could you use for that? Instead of little D, little L. Plus and minus, yeah. Good. It's hard to fool you guys. That's good. We were going to come back in that context and talk about S-omeprazole. What does that mean, S-omeprazole? The S. Who thought it up, that terminology? Yeah. Nathan? Kahn, Ingold, and Prelog. And what's the idea of S?
So you could look at a molecule and figure out what its configuration was without having to have it. So you could just look at it and then look at the arrangement of the substituents around the stereogenic center and figure out.
And figure out what?
The configuration. You could name it.
You could give it a name. It's a scheme for nomenclature, right? So that everybody can understand without having to know how you made the molecule or anything else which one you're talking about. And what did they have to define in order to do that?
They just had it was kind of arbitrary, they just said.
So what was arbitrary?
Well, the ordering by the because it has nothing to do with the actual rotation of the light.
Right. So a substituent with larger atomic weights, what?
Well, it was like a circle around. It's hard to explain.
Yeah, but I might ask you to explain.
Yeah, sorry.
Even if it is hard to explain.
It would look whether it was counterclockwise or clockwise.
Whether what's clockwise or counterclockwise. Now, you say atomic weights.
Not necessarily atomic weights.
We got Nathan on the ropes here.
Higher thing than an inch, for example.
Suppose I have two substituents here, and one is trichloromethyl, and one is chloro. Okay? Which one is heavier? Trichloromethyl or...
By the first one out. It's like a outgoing circle. So you take the first circle around, and then it's right. A tie.
Yeah, you go out until you find a difference. Once you found a difference, then you quit, even if going another step would yield you three chlorines instead of just one. Why? Why would you? Why did they devise the system in that way? Why stop?
It takes less time.
Right. Okay, that's good. What else was invented in stereochemistry? At about we called Byfoot said, I can tell you which one is really which, right? Using anomalous dispersion. And Kahn, Ingood, Gold, and Prelog said, we can name it. If you tell us which one it is, we'll tell you what to call it, and everyone will understand. Okay, both of those, it's not surprising that those happened at the same time, because there was no call for absolute nomenclature until you knew absolute configuration. Okay? But what else happened in stereochemistry at that, within, say, 3 or 4 years of that same time? Remember that almost all the structural things we talk about this semester in organic chemistry happened between what dates? When would you say it sort of started and ended? Roughly. From finding out that there were isomers, say? Go ahead.
It was like 1830.
Yeah. Yeah, but started in 1830, and when did most stuff get figured out, say, through configuration? So we started with composition, then there were isomers, so you knew there was more to it than composition. There must be something else. What was that something else? That it was, you couldn't just say what atoms were there and know what substance you were talking about. What was next? Pardon me?
The bond.
Bonds, constitution. Then what came next? Configuration. And so what time had to elapse for people to do experiments and think about it enough to get that from beginning to end? From composition, say, to configuration. Wojciech? Yeah, so Lavoisier was also already analyzing composition. But what was different between a formula that Lavoisier might write to talk about composition? When was Lavoisier, roughly? End of the 18th century. So 1790 or 89 was his great book. Okay, when was Berzelius? What made analysis really easy compared to what it had been before, elemental analysis? The Kaliaparat, right? And what did the Kaliaparat measure?
CO2,
right? It allowed you to weigh a gas that you made from these things. Okay, so that's great. Okay, now... how much time elapsed between Lavoisier and the Kaliaparat?
60 years.
Yeah, more. It's actually more like 40 years, but that's a long time. Okay. Now, when they could do good analyses, then people wrote formulae. Who had a good idea for writing formulas for composition? The same one we use now, really, almost. Berzelius. Okay. So 1820, 1830, sometime in there. Okay, so it was 20 years from Lavoisier to this. And what formula would Lavoisier have written for a compound? Why couldn't he have written the same one? Same kind, yeah. What? He was interested only in percentage, let's say, but ratio, by mass. So what concept did you need to go from that to go to Berzelius' formulas? You needed atoms and atomic weights, right? Okay, so that's good. But notice that all this stuff happened by 1870. Actually, there was another thing in stereochemistry that happened between that and 1900. Does anybody remember what that is? Pardon me? Van 't Hoff was configurations. That's 1874. What other aspect of the chemical formulas that we that are Zoxy, right? Except it didn't catch on, right? So that was about 1890. Who resisted Zoxy? Why?
He believed in only one isomer, and therefore.
Right, that in cyclohexane there should be two isomers. He thought if Zoxy was correct, what was he missing? Right, that the ring can flip. Okay. Zoxy proposed his structure to explain something about Bayer's theory. What was Bayer's theory that he was trying to strain? Okay, so that's something. That's something that was bit after Van 't Hoff, right? But before the end of the 19th century, the idea that angles had to be certain angles of bonds, right? There was no concept of that before, and that you'd get strain if you had the wrong angle. So Bayer was absolutely right that if you have the wrong angle, you get strain. Why was he wrong about cyclohexane? Why was Bayer wrong about cyclohexane, or in what way was he wrong? Well, it's not planar. So if it were planar, you'd have 120 degree angles and it would be strained. That's what he thought. But it's not planar. Okay. Good. But see, all this was done by 1900. And then it was another 50 years before conformation really became significant. Do you remember what? We didn't really stress much about that. We've actually mentioned the guy who got the Nobel Prize for conformation. Anybody remember his name? It would be a minor point. Barton, and it was about the same time. What did we point out about Barton's structures? That he drew them wrong. In what way were they wrong?
The axes. Taka? The wrong axes.
The axial bonds weren't axial. In his pictures, they weren't parallel to the threefold axis of the six-membered rings. That's good. Okay, so there's three things about stereochemistry that happened in 1950. There was something else about stereochemistry that was developed at the same time. This was really hot times for stereochemistry then. It had to do with notation, sort of, again. Pardon me? The type?
Is that?
I couldn't hear very well.
I thought we were talking about the type and dualism theory.
Type and dualism, would that be around 1950?
No.
When would it be?
Where?
Between 1830 and 1840, okay? So it's not going to be that one. Nobody remembers those by the time you get to 1950.
So CIP?
Yeah, see what? Yeah. Pardon me? Can't hear. When did relative configuration come in? Who is there any name you associate with that? Fisher, when was that roughly? Remember? That's about 1890s, early 1890s too. Okay. What I'm trying to hint about is something that was developed by a Yale graduate. Leon? Pardon me? Newman, yeah. What did Newman contribute? Yeah, a way of drawing structures so configuration was clear, right? With these things like that. That's the Newman projection. Okay, good. That's a good review of a lot of stuff about stereochemistry. Somebody mentioned Gibbs. What did Gibbs contribute? He was a Yale graduate. In fact, if that building didn't exist, you'd see Gibbs' house right there, or where his house used to be. So what did he contribute to chemistry? Pardon me?
Gibbs' free energy constant.
So Gibbs' free energy was named after Gibbs, but he was a modest person. He didn't name it that. What was his famous book? Does anyone remember the title of his book? What's that? Now that somebody, anybody remember what Gibbs's famous book was about? It had to do with thermodynamics. But what was it called? You're close. It was statistical mechanics, but you could have called it statistical thermodynamics. What's statistical? How does statistics come into treating things that have to do with thermodynamics? Yeah.
The low energies preferred over the high energy structure.
That's right. Now, one way statistics come in is that low energy is preferred over high energy. Why?
Because there are more possibilities, a greater number of possibilities of low energy distribution among structures than high energy.
Yeah, I did. Say it again.
So if you have a given amount of energy,
yeah,
and when you distribute it among a greater number of low energy structures rather than a low amount of number of high energy structures.
So yeah, that's good. The point is that if you put too much of the energy you have available what's the most likely amount to have in a single molecule or properly a single degree of freedom?
Zero.
That doesn't seem... I mean, certainly if there's lots of energy around, if things are really hot on the surface of the sun, one would think that the most likely value of energy to have in some particular degree of freedom would be pretty high, right? Is that right or wrong, though? If a molecule is on the surface of a sun, and we're talking about its kinetic energy for motion in the x direction, that's one degree of freedom, a particular degree of freedom. What do you think the most likely value is to have? 1 kilocalorie, 10 kilocalories, 100 kilocalories, 1,000 kilocalories, 0 kilocalories, 1,000,000 kilocalories on the surface of the sun? What's the most likely value to have? Natalie? Why zero? Right, so more of the energy is elsewhere, and what's the advantage of that? That energy that's elsewhere can be permuted in all different ways among other degrees of freedom. And the more of it, more there is, the more permutations, and the more likely. So zero is the most likely. And what did Boltzmann show? Ellen? That it was exponential. Right, zero was the most likely, and it got less and less likely exponentially. Okay, so energy is one aspect of statistics that has to do with thermodynamics. What else? Entropy. Now, how does statistics have anything to do with entropy?
The number of states in the molecule.
The number of what?
The number of states in the molecule. It's not like energy where it's like degrees of freedom, but it's like the amount of ways molecules can arrange.
Yeah, so the more ways you can arrange a molecule, the more favorable it is. That is, you could look at that as a question of nomenclature, sort of. If you use a name that's collective, that all these different structures we're going to call the same thing. I mean, by that token, a hand would be favored over a head, because there are a limited number of things that you could do to change your head. You could blink your eyes, open your mouth, and stuff like that. But your fingers, you could do all this stuff with. So there are lots and lots of different structures here that correspond to a hand, but relatively few like that correspond to a face, right? So that's an advantage of a hand over a face, whatever the energy situation is, right? So that's fundamentally how entropy comes. Now, that's a very classical view, counting those different structures. And you really get into trouble. You have to you have to do something subtle, because if you can count different arrangements, just how fine can the difference be? If you move it, you know, a millimeter, does it count as different? If you move it an angstrom, does it count as different? You can see what the problem is in counting. How does that get taken care of, do you know? How can you do the counting such that you don't have to worry about that? The question gets answered. You know, this is Aisha?
Consider the energy barriers, between Andy and Bosch.
Yeah, but even if you count only things that are within a given well on the potential energy surface, it's how many quantum states there are in there. And you guys are experts on that from all your experience with Erevan meets Goldilocks. You know there are only a certain number of states. And that's what you really count. Right? Okay, yes.
I have a question. When we take into account the entropy factor.
When you do what?
When we take into account the entropy factor, like how many possible states of molecules can be in calculating the K constant, do we also take that into account when calculating the activation energy K, like K13 minus K quarks? Do we also take that into account when
calculating? The way that's properly done is you start at the you use the lowest energy state as the place from which to measure the barrier. And if you think about, if you're getting sophisticated in thinking about it, you use not the bottom of the potential energy surface, right, but the first state. There's 0 point energy, right? So that's where you would start from. And then if there are other states in there, you take them into account by giving the thing a name and calculating entropy. And in fact, it's slightly more complicated than I told you, because if you had, suppose you had a harmonic oscillator. Why would I specify a harmonic oscillator to simplify things? What's the potential for a harmonic oscillator? Alex, you know? Yeah, which is whose name?
Hooke's
Law. Yeah, Hooke's Law. So it's Hooke's Law. Why did I talk about Hooke's Law? What's special about a harmonic oscillator? Right, they're evenly spaced, and an infinite number of them. Now, here we got a problem. It's an infinite number. How are we going to count them? Right? So it's not just the counting. You have to count in the context of Boltzmann. Right, so when you do this entropy thing, you pretend that maybe we shouldn't go into this, but you pretend that everything is in the bottom, but then you adjust its energy by saying there's another state, but a little less of that one, right? Because it's higher in energy, Boltzmann. There's another state, we'll count that one too, but it'll count a little less than these others because there's less of it, and so on. So you weight your counting by how high the energy is. So then you don't have to worry about the fact that there are, in principle, an infinite number of states because the high ones don't count.
But see what? If you had an anti-butane and you were trying to calculate, yeah, if you were to calculate the KEQ of the regular equilibrium constant.
Between that and Gauche?
Between anti and Gauche, you would have to multiply by 2 because there are 2 possible states for the Gauche, right?
That's right.
If you were calculating the activation energy, would you?
You know, that's the place when you're calculating the activation energy. And we'll talk about this more early next semester. That's where we are now, and we'll go on with that. But you're talking about, remember what Eyring's idea was about how you go about counting, calculating rates if you know the potential energy surface? One way is to do, which was not the way he did, was to do trajectories. Roll a marble, either physically as we did in class, or more likely calculate what would happen if you roll a marble, and you get what's called a trajectory. And you see what fraction of the trajectories make it across the transition state and down into the product. Right? And that tells you something. The higher that fraction, the faster the rate. That's one way of doing it. The trouble is that's way too hard, because the number of trajectories is enormous. Okay, so what did Eyring propose instead? Yeah.
Transition state.
Where you say there's a starting substance and a transition state, and then once you have those two, what do? So here's a transition state, it has a certain energy, here's a starting material, it has a certain energy. What use is, though, to me, is knowing those energies if I want to know the rate? You pretend they're in equilibrium. So if they're in equilibrium, you'll know how much is up here if you know how much is here. And once you know how much is up here, how do you get a rate? Yeah. Right. Right, so it's 10 to the 13th per second times however much stuff is up here, which you reckon is an equilibrium from stuff that's down here. But there's sort of a problem about that because it's not a minimum. It's a saddle point, the transition state. So now the question is, how many states are there? Because it's not like this where you have quantum states. It's like this. Right, so that's you have to do a lot of hand-waving, really, to do it. But really, Eyring's point of view was a very good one. It's just, you know, let's not sweat these fine details and just see how far we could get in using this to predict rates, and it works pretty well, right? But when you really press it to try to do it in detail, you have to do much more complicated things. But anyhow, that's good. You know this kind of stuff. What else were we talking? Did we do Gibbs? Did we do all Gibbs? Yeah, so Gibbs statistical. We did two statistical things. There's another statistical thing that has to do with... remember what else we talked about statistically? The law of mass action. And what was the idea there?
It's like... he talked about the dimers or the solution, how it was exponential. And it's...
What's exponential? So if you're talking about an equilibrium constant between single units and pairs of units, then you have an exponent of 2 on the single units. And why does that happen? When you want to get how many of the dimers there are, that you have the concentration of the single ones squared, where does the square come in? I can see that the more of them you have, the more likely you have dimers, but why is it squared? Natalie?
You're also increasing the number of particles in the proximity.
Right, not only are there more particles that could be dimers, but there are more ones more near it, right? So it comes in twice the concentration, so that's why it's squared. What if you required trimers? Right? So you had an equilibrium between a monomer and a trimer. What then? In the equilibrium constant. What do you think, Natalie? I can't hear very well. It's not the three-dimensional aspect of it, because you'd see it in two dimensions. It's there are more particles that could be part of a trimer. That's one. There are more second ones near it. That's a second. That's squared. And then there are more third ones near the pairs. So it's cubed. Okay, so all these things, all these statistical things that have to do with equilibrium, and also if you follow Eyring with rate, right? Because rate is just kind of a sort of equilibrium between the starting material and the transition state. So all these exponents that you get, the delta H over KT, the delta S, the T delta S over RT, and the exponents that we were just talking about of concentrations, all those come from just simple statistical ideas. Okay? Anybody been thinking about other things? Is this going to be your last exam? Good. Okay. The titanium catalyzed thing. So what's the overall reaction that we do, that we want to do? Say in the case of what functional group, we talk about functional groups, what functional group gets oxidized? Yeah. Yeah, it's a S, right? And these are different things. Now, wait a second. Even if we put an oxygen on this, that doesn't look chiral to me. What we're talking about is using a chiral catalyst in order to get a single enantiomer. But it seems to me that even if we have R1 and R2 here, we don't have four different things on the sulfur. That? Okay. In the starting material, there were two lone pairs on S. Now there's one lone pair still, and it can be either coming out or going back. So it's not planar. So it is a chiral. Okay, so we're going to put oxygen on there, is the idea. Okay. Where does the oxygen come from? From air? Pardon me? From a peroxide. What's a peroxide? That's a functional group. It's two O's, okay? So hydrogen peroxide is that. Okay. In fact, what's used as a reagent in the cycle is T-butyl hydroperoxide. So it's got an R group here. It's a T-butyl group. I forgot whether we even mentioned that it was T-butyl. Did I say T-butyl? Anyhow, it's an R group on there. So we're going to have... So what's going to make this group reactive?
Sigma star.
Right, sigma star OO. Okay, and why is it unusually low?
The energies of oxygen.
Can't hear very well.
The energies of oxygen are unusually low because of their higher nuclear charge.
Yeah, because of the high nuclear charge for something that's in the second row. Okay, so... And what's going to be the nuclear? What's going to be the high HOMO that reacts with it?
Unshared pair.
Right. So we're going to have the unshared pair here. Come in on the back, and this will come out. That's the make a bond, break a bond thing that we've talked about so often. And I don't like you writing it like this, because I would prefer. I mean, I just did it, obviously. But it's better to show it where it's going to react and show that those electrons go in between sulfur and oxygen to make the new bond, right? But the problem is this needs we need to have a chiral environment. So what do we start with? Well, what's the catalyst going to be? A catalyst is, this is the reaction we want to do fundamentally, something like that, okay? But we need to that reaction will occur, right? But it won't be a single hand, and it won't be as rapid as it is if you have a catalyst. So you have a catalyst to make it faster, and you have the catalyst be chiral so that you yield a single stereoisomer, the S-omeprazole. Okay, so what's the catalyst? Pardon me? It's titanium. And what makes the titanium chiral? Right, that it has groups on it, O and O, and this stuff is tartaric acid, so that it's a single hand. Okay, now, what happens first? Which of these are the two reagents we're going to react. Which one gets into the act first? Bear in mind that titanium has other OR groups on it as well. You remember what's going to happen?
One of the OR groups.
Brandon?
The peroxide replaces
it. Right. So RO comes off, ROO comes on. Okay, so this one comes off with electrons, then ROO comes on. Okay? And now that's the thing, then, that's going to react with the sulfur. Let's see, just wait a second. The details of it are, let's see now, how does it, does the sulfur replace the other OR? Yeah, this actually, it wasn't known originally, but it's now, but I showed you not a crystal structure of the active form, but what was calculated quantum mechanically, and it showed that these O's, that this O also bonded to the titanium, so that it was TiOOR, but this the unshared pair on this oxygen is also shared with titanium in part, right? So it's sort of a three-membered ring. Okay, so then the sulfur comes on and does that, right? So now we have S with the O on it, which then comes off the titanium and you have the product you want, right? And notice that you also have titanium OR when this bond is broken, as we drew by the arrow, when this one comes off to give the compound that's the product. Right, we then have titanium OR, which is what we started with, remember, OR. Then the OR comes off, ROO comes on, and so on. So we haven't done, obviously we've done very few mechanisms this fall. Mostly we've been focused on structure, and the spring will be reactions and their mechanisms. But what other mechanisms have, this is as much as you need to know about that. Except the fact, what I alluded to at the end here, that the product you get is the OR again, and then you can go around again. So it's a catalyst, it's a cycle. We stress that. But what other reactions? Can you think of a couple other reactions? We didn't talk about many, but what other reactions did we talk about mechanisms of? Yeah. Yeah, we talked about the mechanism of chlorination. Right? What theoretical importance was there to that at the time? They didn't. All they knew was that chlorine reacted with things. Right? They didn't know anything about mechanism. That wasn't for another 100 years. But what did they? What? Even if they didn't know the mechanism, they didn't even know bonds then. Aha! That did in the radical theory. Why? Right, right. So that if you had what we would now write CH3CO, say OH, acetic acid, could be chloridated here, replacing H with Cl once, twice, three times. And so how was that really important? You say the acetyl radical, which was supposed to be an element and not change, changed. What else was bad for the radical theory, or for an aspect of the radical theory, about the fact of that substitution? Debbie?
H had like a positive charge and Cl had a negative
charge. Right, you replaced positive. So dualism was the idea for radicals. And this both changed a radical and was counter to dualism. What's the actual mechanism of it? Do you know how it actually works to do a thing like that, to substitute a CH with a Cl?
It doesn't start with light coming in and like making, splitting the CLCl bonds, so they're so close.
Yeah, so it breaks Cl2 and gives a chlorine atom. Then what? So that pulls an H away from chlorine, away from carbon, attaches it to chlorine.
So you make a CH3 radical.
So now you have CH3 in the case of methane, yeah? So you have CH3 radical, and what does it do? That attacks a chlorine molecule to make the product.
And another Cl.
And another Cl, so it's a cycle. Right? So it's catalytic. So you don't need to do that original breaking of Cl2 very often. Because once you've done it, it'll do lots and lots of this stuff. So that was one way of getting chlorine into an organic molecule. But there was another way of getting chlorine into an organic molecule, too, that did not involve atoms and free radicals. Anybody remember what that was? The addition to an alkene. Okay, and what? So the simplest alkene is ethylene.
Remember a triangle.
Okay, so what makes this reactive? Okay, we've got a high HOMO, pi high HOMO, a pi high HOMO, and we need some LUMO to attack. CLCL. Okay, so that's good. Make a bond, break a bond, just like here. Okay, and so the sigma star was the LUMO. What else was interesting in analyzing this reaction? Do you remember? Say it again.
You had like a three-membered ring.
Yeah, how did you get a three? To make a three-membered ring from a chlorine and two carbons, you need to make two new bonds. We've made one here. We've got one pair of electrons involved.
Two things happened at the same time.
What's that?
Two things happened at the same time.
What's the other thing? Okay. Right. Good. So if you think about it, if you do this and think about it stepwise, what we have first is this CH2, and it's lost electrons when we do this. So this is plus, and the minus is off here someplace in the ether. Okay, you got that. And this is plus, and then what will happen to get the second bond? So a lone pair on chlorine comes in, and now you have that three-membered ring. But remember that's how I went through it, right? And we analyzed it that way. But Brandon, are you going to say something?
I'm just going to ask what the actual orbitals were. Is it the sigma and the pi star?
It looks what?
Is it the sigma and the pi star that are fixing?
Yeah, if it were this, if this were a discrete intermediate, you know, with an angle more like 109 than like 60 degrees here, and then it reaches over and makes the strained ring. If that were so, what would make this reactive? What makes the carbon reactive in the structure I've shown here? Which orbital? High HOMO, low LUMO on the carbon. Low LUMO. Why do you say low LUMO? I can't hear very well. Right, the positive charge is going to make it a good place for electrons, low energy electrons, okay? So what is the low LUMO here? If you had to give it a name, what would it be? Right, it's a P orbital of carbon. Right, and what would the geometry of CH2R, RCH2? RCH2 plus. What would the shape of the bonds at carbon be? Planar or pyramidal? So would it be HHR or HHR, planar? What's this relevant to that we talked about earlier on?
XH3.
Pardon me? Yeah, XH3, right? The BH3, CH3, NH3, cations, anions, unshared pairs, and so on. Okay? So it's planar, and we could spend some time talking about why it's planar. Right? So that's what makes this, and what makes this reactive? It's an unshared pair of electrons, of course. But you remember, why, but actually you don't have this intermediate where this is 109 degrees. Remember what actually happens? That both those things happen at the same time. Not only do you have this HOMO with this LUMO, you have this LUMO with this HOMO, right? An unshared pair that's in a something like a P orbital there, right? So that this plus minus phases of the wave function can overlap with pi star, which is plus minus, and both of these have a node that go down there. So there's an pair of electrons here that interacts with that. There's a pair of electrons here that interacts with that. And you get two new bonds. Yeah, Roy?
But it's the HOMO that attacks the CL sigma star, so wouldn't it be the two lobes of the...
Say it again, please.
Two lobes of the double bond that are attacking the CL.
Yeah.
It's not pi star, right? So they're really...
No, it is. What I'm drawing here is the LUMO. So the two things that are happening is the LUMO of the ethylene plus minus is mixing with the chlorine p orbital plus minus, okay, and at the same time the chlorine sigma orbital or sigma star, pardon me, so which is say like this plus minus sigma star has a node here. Right, is mixing with the pi. Okay? We also talked about an elimination reaction, you remember that? This here, chlorine adds to a double bond. We haven't actually reached the end of the line here. We've got sort of an unhappy molecule, this one. What happens next?
Another Cl comes with a lone pair. That's how
right. Actually, it's Cl minus, which we got here. It's even better lone pair, right? So we got make a bond, break a bond, and the actual product is addition. But you can also do elimination. You can remove groups from adjacent carbons to make a double bond. We talked about that. We talked about, we used F, although F is not used normally, but just because it was a simple halogen atom. If you had this thing and lose H and F, you get a CC double bond. So it's exactly the reverse of what we're talking about here. Do you remember what the orbital looks like that gets it? What does the attacking to cause HF to come off? And what the orbital looks like that it attacks? OH minus is the thing that attacks. And where does it attack? Right, it attacks from out here, OH minus. So this comes in. And what does it do? Right, so these electrons go here. And what else? These electrons go here. And you'd do you remember what the nature of the molecular orbital was that OH minus was attacking? I mean, you draw the curved arrows in this way. But you can understand why certain bonds break and other bonds form if you look at the orbital that's being attacked. Yeah. Pardon me? I wouldn't say it's pi star LUMO, I don't think. Okay, you take two sigma stars and do their favorable combination. Why take their favorable combination? That's going to be the lowest of all. If you have two low LUMOs that you're thinking about, which are just pairwise, and you take into account their interaction, they're going to mix to give two other unoccupied orbitals. But the lowest, the favorable one, the one that went down in energy, is the one you're interested in. So it's the favorable combination of the sigma star here and sigma star here. Right? So it looks like looks like this, H. So qualitatively, it's this antibonding here, some bond, some orbital like that, so plus, minus, plus, and an antibond here, which has something of the fluorine and an orbital of carbon here. Now, what's, I've got to put signs in here. What sign should I put here? Here I should put negative and here positive. Why should I do that? To make it the favorable interaction here. So it's the one that went down, the low LUMO. And then this is antibonding here, so I make that minus. And now when we put electrons in there that come from OH minus, from mixing with OH minus, so this vacant orbital becomes occupied. What influence does that have on bonding within this set of atoms? Where is it bonding and where is it antibonding? How about here? Between H and C, bonding or antibonding if we put electrons in here? Antibonding here, that's going to break. How about between F and C? And how about between C and C? That's what's going to make the double bond when we put electrons into that. Okay, that's good, and something different from talking about the rotational barrier of ethane, which we spent our last time together harping on. Yeah.
In Fischer projections,
We
have bent bonds. So Fischer explains them as two projections that are coming out of the plane of the paper, and then the carbon atoms are in a straight line. But how does that actually work?
All he wanted was an unambiguous way to convey the what? Which of the C's did he want to show? Composition, constitution, configuration, conformation. Which one was he interested in?
Configuration.
So all he wanted was a way, a notation that he could use that would show somebody exactly which configuration he was thinking of, right? So his idea was the carbon he knows is tetrahedral, and there'll be some complicated shape for the overall molecule. But for purposes of making a drawing that will convey the configuration of a particular carbon, he's going to say that the bonds that come toward you are this in three dimensions, and the ones that are vertical are going back in. And then when you draw four things around that carbon, you know the absolute configuration of that carbon, although he worked only with relative configuration. But he said, I'll assume that the glyceraldehyde, which is D, has CHO here coming back in OH, you know, and H coming out and so on. Okay, now, if you tried to read the wrong thing into a Fischer projection and assume that he was trying that these were tetrahedral, if you were trying to view the molecule as a whole, it looks really nutty, because the bond that goes back into the, from this carbon, the bond that goes back into the paper, the bond from this carbon also goes back into the paper, so the bond would have to be bent like that. And in a sense, that's not an accident, because the way he got the idea of drawing that way was working with models that had rubber tubing for bonds. So it was possible to bend the bonds that way. He didn't think that that's what really happened. In fact, he invented this just at the time, within 3 or 4 years of when Beyer was talking about strain theory. And I hadn't told you before, but Fischer was a graduate student of Beyer, so they were well acquainted. And in fact, he was having breakfast with Beyer down on the Italian Riviera when they were trying to understand Van 't Hoff. I actually mentioned this, but I didn't dwell on it. Van 't Hoff had predicted how many stereoisomers you should have for a particular compound, and they couldn't figure it out, and they tried with bread rolls and toothpicks, and they couldn't figure it out. But then when he got back to his lab, he said, aha, if I have these models that aren't made with toothpicks, but are made with rubber tubing, then I can bend it and draw it that way. And once you draw it that way, you know, nowadays, chemists are accustomed to drawing things in three dimensions and figuring out isomers. This was far from any of their experience. But once he drew it in a Fisher projection, then he could count this way, this way, this way, this way, and so on, and figure it out. But he wasn't attempting to draw what the molecule would actually look like if you had a microscope that could do it. Incidentally, why can't a microscope do it? Why can't a microscope? Well, what ways are there of actually seeing molecules and how things are in it? Pardon me?
Even the best microscope can't resolve the bond.
Why not? Right. The way you can only see things where you get diffraction, where you get interference. And if things are close together compared with the wavelength of the light, the scattering from the two is essentially the same. They don't interfere with one another as you change angle. And therefore, the light has no information in it about how far apart the things are. So what other ways are there besides trying to use a microscope of seeing, of knowing that they're atoms, or even that they're molecules for that matter? Okay, so atomic force you mentioned. Is that, that's a subclass of techniques, yeah, Amy? Scanning probe microscopy, of which atomic force microscopy is another. What's another kind? Scanning tunneling. Which gives higher resolution? Which is more likely to show you? And why?
The probe itself is smaller.
The probe is smaller because for tunneling, you can tunnel through one atom. But if you try to bend a lever by touching just one atom, it won't work because either you'll break the atom off or it'll start pressing down into the sample and the sample will deform and you won't see it well. If you need press hard enough that something will bend. But you can be close and not touch and have electrical current flow, have electrons go, right? Go through a region where they have where they're not near either nucleus. Right? They're very high, the electrons are relatively high energy when they go from the tip down to here. How can they get through there? How can they get over a barrier that has such high energy? And still go fast enough that you can measure a current. Right, because they have negative kinetic energy. They tunnel. It's scanning tunneling microscopy. Okay, So that way, can you see bonds with scanning tunneling microscopy? If you're feeling with just one atom, might you be able to see bonds? No, you get close, but you don't see it. You could measure amazing things by making these tiny probes with scanning probe microscopy, and that's one of the biggest growth industries of the last 30 years in science. But you don't see bonds. So how do you see bonds? Clairvoyance? Okay, how do you do it? So you use X-ray diffraction. And now, can you see a single bond? I don't mean a single double triple, but I mean one bond. Can you see one bond? Can you do X-ray diffraction in the gas phase to see a bond or the structure of a molecule? Why not? Can't hear very well. Yeah, you get scattering from a whole lattice. So what's the other word that goes with X-ray diffraction? Crystallography. You need the things that are regular, right? Because the whole group then does the scattering, and you get much more things that you can actually measure. In principle, you could do scattering from a single molecule, but the trouble is that it would be way too weak to detect. Okay, so but to have a whole crystal and all the things cooperating, then you can do it. And now, what information is there in the scattering that comes out from X-ray? So X-rays get bent different directions, right? The X-ray beam comes in, it comes out of a bunch of as a bunch of little pencils. Actually, it's interesting. I was giving a lecture about this yesterday to a lawyer in New York. I was being deposed in a patent case, and he wanted to know how x-rays worked. So I told him the same thing I told you. He asked if this was from chemistry 125, because it turned out he had some friend of his had taken 125 20 years ago, and he had heard about this. So anyhow, these come out in a bunch of little beams, and each one, of course, has a certain intensity, right? Now, what determines the direction in which they come out? Yes? Oh, yeah, it has to do with how the closer things are together in real space, the higher the angle you get. What do you call that kind of relationship, remember? Reciprocal. You talk about reciprocal space. But there are two features of the scattering that comes from X-ray. One is the pattern of spots, where they occur, and the other is the intensity of the spots. And what do these tell you? Luke? Yeah, it's within the unit cell, the arrangement of atoms within the unit cell. And what does the actual position of the dots tell you?
The spacing between the actual unit cells.
Right, the spacing of the unit cells from one unit cell to the next, whereas the intensity tells you what's within the cell. Good. We're sort of free associating here, right? So what got us into that? Oh, that was another way, the other way of looking at things to see that they're atoms. Now, does that show? Does X-ray diffraction then show you bonds? What if you use this kind of quote X-ray vision, right? That you get this way. Do you see bonds? What do you see if you look at a molecule? What does a molecule look like to X-rays? Pardon me?
Separate atoms.
It looks like a bunch of atoms, right? So, no information about bonds? How do you get information about bonds?
Difference density.
Ah, you do a difference density map. What's the difference between? Right, it's what you would calculate for isolated atoms for the scattering compared to what you actually observe, right? That's the difference density. So what then gives rise to difference density? Right, it shows the electron shift from where they were in atoms to where they are in molecules, and most they don't shift very much, right? About how much shift is there? How much electron density is there in bonds? It's about a 20th of a Lewis, right? 5% of a Lewis. So it's not a big shift, and you know when you look at the X-ray. Electron density calculated X-ray, it looks mostly just like atoms. Okay, that's good. Then we talked about quantum mechanics, of course. We've talked about some of that here with HOMOs and LUMOs and things. What's worth talking about there?
Why do we use calculated densities rather than just observe a single
atom? Well, you can't have an X-ray of a single atom. Well, you can, but it's very, very weak. The main reason you do that is because of convenience. Because the methods of calculating atoms quantum mechanically are really very, very, very good. We could talk a little bit about that. That's worthwhile. If you wanted to do, is it possible to do a quantum mechanical calculation of electron distribution that really is correct, where you're not, I shouldn't say that but for purposes of this class where it's really correct, because, you know, you get into problems with relativity and stuff like that are beyond what we talk about. But we've talked about things about quantum mechanics as we treat it normally being an approximation. Are there any wave functions where you really have the true wave function and you can write it down in a simple form? Of course, simple is in the mind of the beholder, I guess. For what system?
Hydrogen.
You mean H2? Hydrogen molecules? Aha. What's the key thing? He says, so hydrogen, fine. How about helium? How about uranium? Are they just as easy? Why? Why can you only do one electron atoms? What's the complication when you have many electrons? Because they repel one another, right? And now you get into real trouble in trying to solve the equations. Okay? So what recourse do you have? What do you do if you just throw up your hands and say, okay, I can't do anything more than one electron? Pardon me?
You can do Z effective.
So what's Z effective? What's Z?
Z is the charge of the protons on the nucleus, and you can basically just change it to make it less than it actually is, and that'll account for the
right.
Smaller radius.
Yeah, so you could sort of a little bit take into account that there are other electrons around by pretending that the nucleus doesn't have as big a charge. So Z effective. So you could do that. What's better than that? And what's the gist of self-consistent field?
So like you use the effective as a start point, but you would take kind of one electron and hold all the other electrons as like one cloud.
Yeah.
Just keep go and like adjust that for the cloud and then go to the next one and keep going around and around.
Right.
Adjusting.
Right, so if in the Z effective, you assume that those electrons that you're neglecting are at the nucleus, so they just reduce the nuclear charge. This is better because you let them be spread around rather than being on the nucleus. That sounds really good to me. Is that now right? Antonia, what do you say? What's wrong? It doesn't account for the fact that the other electrons move when you move your electron around. Okay, so correlation's a problem. And there are techniques we mentioned just by name that you can use to estimate the problems in correlation, like configuration interaction and so on. Okay. Do any of you think of things that you want to talk about? Sure, yeah. Sure. Yeah, I'm glad to do this. I think it's worthwhile to do. But one thing that we should remember in focusing here is that we will cover all these different topics from earlier. Not all, but we will cover topics from earlier. We can't cover them all, right? But we won't cover them in anything like the detail that we did as we went on focusing entirely on that. We're taking a broad brush view of the semester as a whole, and half the test is a finer examination of the more recent material. But let's just the way we often do it is to draw a wave function and figure out what the potential is. Is that what you'd like to do?
Yeah.
Okay, so here's, what am I drawing here? That's zero, so positive and negative values. And let's just make it like this. Okay, like that. Okay. So that's a wave function which solves for a given potential. What do you need to know besides the potential? What has to be given you to do a quantum mechanical problem? The mass, too, right? So there's a certain mass that this is for. We are not going to specify that. We want to just see what the potential energy, qualitatively, what it looks like. So how do we go, as this goes out, why is this asymptotic out here on both sides? What do you know about the potential from the fact that it's asymptotic on both sides? That it's bounded, right? It goes up high on each end. Okay, so it's up here someplace, up here, and out here. And some. Okay, now where else can you tell me anything about the wave function? How about here? Can you tell me something about the wave function here, here and here? Those two points? What can you tell me something about the potential at those two points?
Divide by zero, what?
Divide
divide the curvature by the...
So what do you know about the potential energy at those two points? Those are the only two points where you know nothing about it. Right? Because it's a zero. It's got to be a zero divided by zero kind of thing or something like that. So you don't know anything about it there. The point you made is the correct one. It's a division by zero, so you don't know anything about it here and here. But every place else, you know something about the potential. And then, once you know something about the potential either side of that, you know that it probably is smooth as it goes through there. So those aren't the places you know anything. Where do you know something? Say, here. What do you know in that position? That it's curving away from the baseline. What does that tell you? It tells you let's just use the same line to be where the potential energy is the same as the total energy, okay? So now we're going to see whether if the kinetic energy is negative, then the potential energy is going to be down. And if the kinetic energy is... Did I say the wrong thing? If the kinetic energy is positive, we're going to go down from this line. If it's negative, we're going to go up. Okay? So what do we know here? It has to be up here someplace, so it's coming like that. Okay? How about here? It's got to be down here someplace. It's right. And exactly how much up and down is going to be... What's going to determine how much up and down? What determines not just the sign, but the magnitude of the kinetic energy? It's the curvature divided by the value. So it's a scaled thing. Okay? So here, that's a certain value. Let's say it's here. So now, and we know that there's some place between here and here that this thing goes through our zero. The thing we've defined as zero, where the kinetic energy is zero. Where is it going to be? Where the inflection point is, which, you know, it's hard to see. It's pretty straight, but maybe there. Okay, so it's like this. Okay. And now, does it start curving back up like that? How about here? How about here? Should we draw our potential energy above or below? Still below, right? It's still curving toward the baseline. All through here, it's curving toward the baseline. In fact, there must have been an inflection point there so that it could be curving toward and then still curving toward. Okay? I mean, I didn't draw it precisely. Okay, so all through here. And do you think the kinetic energy is higher here or here? Higher here, why? Because this one is less curved and a bigger divisor. Okay, so it's got to be going such that it gets up a little here. You know, we're not talking about fine details here. Okay, how about here? Right, now we got to be above the baseline. We got a negative kinetic energy curving away, so it's got to come up like that somehow. In fact, notice it's curving sharply here compared to here, right? And it's got about the same magnitude, so it had to get up higher than this was. Right. See what I mean? How about here? Now it had to come down like this. I'm right, huh? Yeah. Because it's much further down. Whoops! It's much further down here than it was here, because they have the same divisor but a much stronger curvature. So it did funny things here. Okay, and now we got funny behavior here, where it's curving away and then curving toward, and then then curving toward. So here it's curving away, so it has to come back up here somehow, and then go back down and stay down somehow, and then it has, at this inflection point, it has to go through zero, and then it goes up there, something like that. Okay? Is that the kind of thing you wanted to do, Debbie?
Yes.
Okay, but you know, if you think about what we have time to ask on the final, probably that isn't worth enough. I mean, doing a good answer on that would take too much time to be what it's worth in the context of the course as a whole. Yeah.
Why are there more contest states in like a deeper well or
more contest?
I for the whole twist boat.
Yeah, well, the fundamental idea is that if you could have a steep potential, or you could have a shallow potential, right? And there's what about the spacing of quantized levels here and here?
It's big on the left, but
so that there are big spacings here, and small spacings here. And the reason is that if your wave has to be between here and here, right? If this is the total energy, this is where there's zero kinetic energy, right? So that means because if the total energy is the same as the potential energy, you have zero kinetic energy. So if we're drawing our wave function here, right? This is the place where there have to be inflection points, right? So the wave has to be between here and here. That's where the inflection points are going to be. I haven't drawn it well. Sort of like that. Inflection point here and inflection point here, right? And this was going to have, what's this one going to look like? Right, it's going to have a node. But again, it's going to have an inflection point here and an inflection point here. So it's going to look like maybe this. Right? And here there's going to be two nodes and so on. Now here, the one that has no nodes looks like this. It has an inflection point here and an inflection point here. So it looks like this. Right? What's the difference? Well, it's true, but I mean, I haven't. The trouble was, I didn't make this line much longer than that one. It should have been, this one should be longer than that one. Okay. In fact, I guess what I did was draw that too low, maybe, or something like that, and say it's there. I mean, this is still much lower from the bottom than this one is. Right? So this one is actually like that. So this one has much more energy than that one does. How do you know? Just by looking at it. Because it's much more curved, because it's combined in a much shorter space. Right? So this is, then the differences between these also, there's not only is there not much curvature here, but there's much more curvature here than there is here. There's more curvature here than here, but not nearly as much as here. Right? So these are closely spaced, these are broadly spaced. Okay? And it coincides with the classical idea that there's not much space here. This one is held rigidly, whereas this one is much more floppy. It can go back and forth much further. So it's not surprising that there's a parallel. It may be surprising that the parallel is quantitative, that you can get the same answer by doing it classically and doing it quantum mechanically. But if it didn't quite work, you'd believe the quantum mechanics, not the classical one. Yeah?
But these are the quantum states of the whole molecule.
No, this is just for one. What are we plotting here? What are the two coordinates? Vertical axis is energy or wave function amplitude. What's the horizontal?
Structure.
It's structure, but what structure? What do you mean?
One chair, two.
Remember what we do, what's Erwin meet Goldilocks treat?
Position.
One particle in one dimension. So things like this, wave functions that you can draw on the blackboard or a piece of paper, are one particle in one dimension.
But what we're dealing with is not...
But if you're talking a molecule, so you're talking about 3n dimensions, where n is the number of atoms.
How can
atoms.
You talk about chair and chair?
Oh, you can't. That's why it's... if you want to... The picture we actually drew has to be the reaction coordinate. Remember, in the last lecture, we talked about a reaction coordinate. Do you remember that? We talked about a potential energy surface, where and it, remember, it's only what the surface I showed you in class, or the surface that Eyring calculated, is for what system? Maria, do you know?
Three atoms.
Yeah. Any three atoms? Pardon me?
Like a bond between two and then another.
Oh, yeah, but that depends on where you are, right? If you have three atoms, different points on it would be these two close, this one far away, these two close, this one far away, or all of them close, or all of them far away, right? But there's something else besides it just being three atoms. How many dimensions do you have to deal with? There are only two dimensions to talk about the geometry. The third dimension is energy. So how can you talk about three particles and just talk about two dimensions? See what I mean? Why that's tough? Natalie?
They're in a line.
They have to be in a line. So it's a very special thing that you where you can draw it explicitly. Three atoms in a line you can do in two dimensions. Right? Now, but then we showed a plot that showed starting material, transition state, products. A plot like that, and we showed a line that went over the transition state and down to the products. And we said that the horizontal coordinate there is the reaction coordinate. Now, you can mean that to mean nothing, just to say that there's starting material with its energy and its entropy, there's the transition state with its enthalpy and its entropy, there's the product with that. You could calculate the equilibrium constant between these, multiply by 10 to the 13th per second and get the rate and so on. Or you could think of it as going along a particular line on the potential energy surface, the one that was the steepest descent from the transition state down into one valley. Then you slice it along there, fold it out, and now you have a two-dimensional plot of energy versus a particular coordinate, right? But it's coordinated motion of the particles. Right, is one particular trajectory. There'd be others where they coordinate their motion differently.
So when we're looking at a graph where we're looking at on the left the chair structure and and the other structure, then are we just assuming that there's this one particle that's actually?
No. So the way it would be in a sample with many atoms like cyclohexane, is that you'd take the transition state, which is that. Half chair. Remember, you bring one up, then it clicks. Then you bring the other one down, it clicks. The one up just as you go before it clicks, so you're at the maximum at the transition state, right? And then you start your energy there, and you find how you go down to the starting material, the chair, the steepest possible way. There's the steepest way to go in many dimensions. Right, the least motion that will give you the biggest energy change. It's some coordinated motion of all the atoms, but you can follow that down to the starting material. You can follow it then beyond the transition state to the twist boat, and so on. So if you sliced in many dimensions, but sliced along that, you'd have a particular trajectory of all the atoms and the energy it corresponded to. Then you could talk about this. But in truth, it's going to be, it's many dimensional, and there are other kinds of motion you get too. Again, not many people think that's appropriate fodder for an organic chemistry course. So don't overemphasize something as complicated as that. Yeah? Go over what? Topicity?
Yeah.
Yeah, what does topicity mean? What does the name mean? It means placeness. right? And what, so what is it? Well, what's the idea of placeness? In speaking of topicity, there are three relationships of places. You remember the names of the three? Homotopic, enantiotopic, diastereotopic. And what do those mean? Homotopic? They're the same. They're superimposable. Enantiotopic? They're related as mirror images, right? And diastereotopic? They're just plain different, right? So and so when you talk about protons, as we said, for example, you can say that protons are homotopic, enantiotopic, diastereotopic. You could say that two methyl groups are homotopic, enantiotopic, two chlorine atoms in different molecules, homo, enantio, diastereo, or within the same molecule for that matter. So then you have to decide, and why are you interested in this kind of thing? Because if they have different environments, their reactivity could be different. Their spectral properties can be different. So, for example, in NMR, if two protons are homotopic, they'll give the same signal. If they're enantiotopic, they'll give the same signal unless. Do you know what the unless would be if they're enantiotopic? Two protons within a certain molecule are enantiotopic. But you do NMR in solution. If the solvent is chiral, then those hydrogens, which considered just within the molecule, were mirror images. When you consider them in the context of a single enantiomer of the solvent, they now become diastereotopic, and you'll get two signals. Right? So interpreting NMR spectra was the place that I first became aware of the importance of this distinction. Okay? No, no, they can be conformational, too, in principle. Remember, let me think if this is a good example. Yeah, a case of, well, just about, how do you interconvert conformational enantiomers? Can you have conformational enantiomers? Right, things that are twisted one way and the other. Can you think of a specific example of something that might be conformationally enantiomeric? Ethanol? Okay, we'll talk about ethanol, but that's not the example you want. This is the one we actually talked about in class. So here we have five hydrogens. And remember that these topic names talk about relationships, the same way enantiomer. A compound can be an enantiomer of one thing and a diastereomer of something else. The terms describe relationships. Okay, so how about this hydrogen and this hydrogen? Do they have the same place? No, in no way. So they're heterotopic. You usually reserve those words to talk about things that involve configuration or conformation, stereochemistry, not constitution, just because it doesn't surprise anyone that these two are different. So you don't need a really fancy word for that, because they're not the same at any level. Okay. Now, how about this one and this one? Are those environments the same? No, obviously they're not. This is closer to the O than that is. But you can rotate, right? So when you rotate, this one can go where that one is, and this one can go where that one is. So if it rotates, and you're interested in some property that has a time average to it, then they're the same. They're homotopic. So most people would call them homotopic, and because the difference between them is only conformational. And conformations rotate? What kind of barrier do you have for rotation about FA and say, I knew we'd get there sooner or later? How big is the barrier? And how fast would it interconvert then if the barrier is 3 kilocalories per mole? So it's going to be something like 10 to the 10, 10 to the 11 times a second. Right? I'm tempted to tell you what I was talking to this lawyer about because it was exactly that. But we actually even talked about that yesterday. But we have other fish to fry here. Okay, so those two are conformationally diastereotopic. But who cares? Right? Because they're going to interconvert so rapidly that configuration is going to be a much bigger deal, usually. Okay, incidentally, how about these two? Those are enantiotopic, but only conformationally, right? So again, it's going to average rapidly, and you don't care. Now, how about this one and this one? Those are just plain heterotopic, right? Constitutionally, just the same as this was, right? They're connected in a different way. Nature and sequence of bonds. So nobody's surprised that those are different. How about these two? Those are enantiotopic. Is it conformational or is it configurational? Yeah, because rotation isn't going to interconvert these two. Does everybody see that?
That's if you like substitute.
Right. If you had a reagent, like the chiral titanium thing that would react with not that particular one, but something like that that could react with hydrogen, it could react with one and not the other.
Okay, it can,
right? And the rotation is not going to hurt you in that. Okay, so these are the ones that are really important to have a name that distinguishes them. Do you remember how you get such a name so that you could tell someone else what it is, which one you're talking about? Roy?
It was pro R and pro S, but I have another question, which is if you do have something that's conformationally an antiotopic, can you also get pro R and pro S?
No, it's not pro R and pro S, because if I replace this one with, say, chlorine, or replace this one with chlorine, that doesn't become a chiral center. In fact, what you can call it is, and I think there are examples, you could call it pro-R, because you'd need two substitutions to change it into RRS. See what I mean? Okay, let's not go there, though. Time is finite between now and Friday. Okay. Anyhow, does that answer the kind of thing you were interested in? Oh, then in the play, but I asked you, can you think of something where the difference is conformational, but the rate might be slow? And you, that's what happened. And you said ethanol, and I said we'll talk about ethanol, but that's not going to be slow. You're telling me it's 10 to the 10th a second. I want something that's going to last minutes or hours. What? Binaphthyl, did you say? Yeah, that's true, except we didn't talk about it. So, in fact, I'll tell you, naphthalene is this. It's two benzene rings together. And binaphthyl is this. So that's two naphthyls, right? And now there's a very important ligand for metals to do chiral catalysis, and it's called binap. So it's binaphthyl, but it has nitrogen here, or phosphorus, I guess. Which one is it? Anyhow, it's one. There's one with phosphorus, one with nitrogen. Let's put nitrogen just for simplicity. So this has a couple things. Let's say methyl groups. I think it's probably other phenyl groups or something. So then the neat thing is you can have these two both attack a single metal. So you have some metal whose vacant orbitals are stabilizing those electrons and also those electrons. So you have that. Now, that's useful for enantiomeric specificity and catalysis, the same as titanium. in the titanium, you remember, this thing out here was based on tartaric acid, so it was chiral, right? But the thing that's here, where the two things are attached to a metal, this bit, where is the chiral center? Where's the carbon that has four different things on it? This one? That doesn't have four different things. It has a carbon, and a nitrogen. It's planar.
It doesn't have a chiral.
It doesn't have a chiral. What is it that makes that chiral? Why can you sell that for a lot of money and get the Nobel Prize if you invented it, which one guy did? He shared the Nobel Prize with Sharpless. What? How can this bit here be handed? Right, because these two, H here and H here, want to be in the same place. Right, they can't be like that, coplanar. They have to twist one way or the other, twist right-handed or twist left-handed. And that's so slow to change that conformation. It's rotation around this bond we're talking about, but it's so hard to push one H past the other that it's stuck, and you can sell this stuff in a bottle and use it to make something that's chiral, right? So it's only conformation, but it lasts a long time. Is that what you had in mind when you said naphthol?
Yeah, I think
who talked about it?
John.
Oh, I see. John talked about it in the... Okay. How are we doing for time here? Oh, this 10:02. We did it right on the button. But if you have another question, I'll answer it. But I think this has been a good session because we've gone through lots of different topics, not just talking about the rotation of ethane the whole time. Okay.